Okay, I think we're good. We're as good as we're going to get for tonight. So I just, let's see, 8:05 or 10, I forget what you, pardon me? 8:10, okay, good. So we have 22 minutes here. I'm going to stop wherever we get to tonight, we'll stop. I really spent a couple of hours yesterday trying to figure out how could I come here and summarize the Gita in 20 minutes. It's actually what I wanted to do. About an hour and a half into it, it was just impossible because, you know, first I thought I would just read the first line of every chapter and let myself feel what the message was there and then just relay that. I mean, you can't. It just draws you in. Each chapter...
You couldn't say...
It was virtually impossible, I think it would have been for anybody. It just, there's no fat in the book. If I may say that, I mean, every line, of course, is right from God, and it's just so profound, and every line we could do a course on, which, of course, we're not going to do. But as you can see, I did find in the 16th chapter this list that I'd forgotten was there of spiritually ennobling qualities that lift us towards awareness of the divine. This is all from Krishna, and it's in a chapter that's entitled The Nature of the Godly and the Demonic, and I left the demonic out for tonight. I decided since we had just a little bit of time, I would go towards the godly. But, you know, I read through them yesterday, and I read through all of Swamiji's commentaries on each of them, and then today I decided to type them up for you, which I've done, just the qualities. Of course, not the commentary, but it's very profound focusing on these. And what I realized as I was redoing this today is that really in these 26 qualities is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, I didn't think I could do it, and Divine Mother just handed it to me. It was to all of us, really. So in 20 minutes... There's 26 of these, so you can do the math. We're not going to spend a lot of time on any one of them. But I thought it would be good just to read through them and maybe make a couple of comments on each of them. The expanded commentary is, of course, here for anybody to read who wants to read it. But what he says is that this really becomes like a summary. I mean... Even Krishna says that to Arjuna, and then Swami says it. So here we are. So the first quality is, and let me just say to you, because I'm handing them out to you, at 8:10 I'm going to stop, so wherever we are, we are. We'll just do what we can do, and then you have the rest, and everybody has access to the book, because Swamiji's commentary on all of this, like everything in the Gita, it's so profound. It's amazing how difficult it would be for any one of us to just read the Gita and get it. I mean, it really takes divine perception. And I think we've been having an experience, I did tell Biraj last week after his class, that it's been very touching. I couldn't be here tonight, obviously, but sitting in the hour that he does, clearly he has read the Gita so many times, and he has... I don't think just absorbed the material, but I think really awakened to so much of the true meaning in it that just the way he reads it makes it much more understandable for us. A message comes through just by the energy that he's been putting into it. I for one, have been very grateful about that. So I think for any one of us, you know, I've always said when I tell stories about my life, and most of you have heard me say this, I never feel like I'm just telling a story about my life or me. I share stories because what happens to one of us happens to every one of us. If I could have the experience, we can all have the experience. So when we share miracles or what look like miracles, it's not by way of saying, look at what happened to me. It's by way of saying, everything is possible. Everything for every one of us in every moment. All we need to do is keep lifting our vision up towards the divine. And in some way, it is that simple. remind ourselves over and over, keep our attention focused at the point between the eyebrows. It's so simple that we don't believe it, and we let it go. We're waiting for something so dramatic that we miss the opportunity in every moment of our life. And I'm saying it to you because here's a man who's just been reading the Gita. He said to me, that's what I did on all those flights back and forth to India. I walked up and down the aisle and up and down the aisle reading these stanzas, and I think we've all had an opportunity to hear the impact that it's had on him. For most of us who don't walk up and down the aisle and up and down the aisle, we open to chapter 29 of Swamiji's book, and it's really quite beautiful. So the first quality that that Krishna says, and there's a whole chapter here, and he says to him, the Blessed Lord said, fearlessness, and he just starts listing all of these qualities. It's just Krishna saying, I'm going to give you this list, and that's all Krishna does for Arjuna. Remember, he wasn't explaining it for him, but Swamiji gives us an explanation of each of them. And when he talks about fearlessness, and I wrote here, comes with perfect non-attachment, because we all know that what creates fear is our attachment to anything. We wouldn't be afraid if we didn't feel that we had to have something, whether it's attaining some material goal, whether it's the opinion of others that bothers us, whether it's needing love in a certain form. Whatever it is, we're attached to something in this world outside of ourselves, and the only reason that we're ever afraid, I mean, you can try it on with any time you feel any fear. If you ask yourself, wait a minute, what am I afraid of? You'll realize that it's something that you are attached to, that you're afraid you're not going to be able to achieve or receive or manifest. And so Swamiji's saying to us, it's always this non-attachment that will lead us away from fear. And really, in a way, what he's saying, of course, is the bottom line lesson, which is easy to say in a sentence, hard to make real. But any time that we believe that we're separate from the divine, any time we move into this state of duality, then there's something else that we want. The more often we can draw our energy in and rest in the very core of who we are. And I often talk, when I'm talking in other classes or with my clients for that matter, about what it means to be in love. I don't mean be in love the way most people talk about it, but to be resting in love. And God is, of course, love. We cannot know fear in that place. The next one is purity of heart. And again, I tried to take paragraphs here. Comes when one has removed from his heart any feeling, foreign to his true nature. So really what Krishna is saying is that if you really step back from anything that's nurturing or nourishing your ego and step away from that so that you can find your true nature, that is, and last week in the Gita readings, remember we were talking about citta and vrittis, and we were talking about calming the vrittis, calming emotion. What's the difference between emotion and calm feeling in the heart? And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about moving away from everything that gives us an outwardly emotional reaction and moving more towards being in our heart, opening our heart, and constantly remembering God. Now, it's not just the positive thing. It's also, bearing no malice in a way. All of the negative, all of the judgment. Again, I mean, we could go back, all of the fear. So it's really moving away from anything that takes us away from our true nature. Swamiji has a sentence here at the end of this little explanation. He said, all the spiritual qualities listed above, absence of malice, harmlessness, forgiveness, truthfulness, all of those things that are genuinely our nature, we're going to come to all of them because there are these 26 ennobling qualities. Perseverance, but then Krishna qualifies it. And he says he's talking about perseverance in the acquisition of wisdom and in the practice of meditation. So we're talking about applying willpower to that which is dharmic, really, is the word. I was going to say to that which is worthy, but I mean, what does that mean? Of course, that leaves a lot open to our own personal understanding of things. But perseverance towards anything that is dharmic, and dharmic means, remember, we said last week, anything that leads to expansion of our consciousness. That really is the definition of dharmic. Anything that winds up being contractive, that becomes more about me, mine, ego, downward pulling, those things are not, they're not dharmic. They're really heading in the opposite direction. So anything that's dharmic, it means persevering in the sense of not allowing ourselves to be dissuaded or sidetracked from that which will lead to an expansion of consciousness. There's a young man in our community. He lived here for a number of years. Then he took off for a while. He traveled through India a little bit, then lived in Italy for quite some time, and he's back now. And he's really grown and matured, spiritually matured, so much in these years that he's been gone. It's just a pleasure spending time with him right now. But he's in an awkward position. He came back. He was about to go to graduate school. He's changed his mind. He's not going to do that. And now he's feeling like, what I need to do is make money so that I can go back to Italy or India and support myself while I serve there, which is wonderful. I mean, it's a good goal. But I told him the story. Did I tell you the story last week here about the man from Findhorn who was working on his driveway? I know some of you have heard it. Peter Caddy is his name. I haven't been able to remember his name. He came to visit Swamiji at one point, years, this is many years ago. And they were just having spiritual discourse, a satsang, amongst these two, you know, both of them very great souls. I mean, Peter Caddy and Swamiji. And however they got to this subject, Peter said, well, let me tell you a story. He said, we have been wanting to build a new driveway for Findhorn for years and years and years. And he said, finally, we found the energy, we found the people, we found the money. We started the driveway. He said, we got about three quarters of the way complete, and somebody wanted me to turn my attention to another project. And for a while I fought, and I kept saying, no, I have to finish the driveway. But they kept saying, you know, you'll get right back to it, don't worry. And he said to Swamiji, in a moment of confusion, I let myself be sidetracked. And he said, that was over 8 years ago, and the driveway is sitting unfinished. Well, Sunday after church, I told this young man that story, and I was so sorry I did. Literally, he went, oh. I mean, you could just see him. He was devastated by the story. He really got it, and it actually terrified him. He just stopped me today. I said, no, let's meet again. We have to. It wasn't meant to terrify anybody, but it is interesting how easy it is in the... As I said, I'm not going to worry about where I get. There's a wonderful, wonderful story. I can't remember if it's Narda or who it is, but there's a very great soul who's talking to God. And he said, I don't understand. How is it that people get so sidetracked? How can they not follow the path, just see what it is and do it? And I have to say, there are times where I'm sure each of us, when we're looking at somebody else, we have that feeling like, don't they see where to go? Just so easy to think that. And
see you in my next life.
Yeah, right. So it was Narda, wasn't it, who left? So Narda was talking to God. So God said, Narda, I'm so thirsty. Can you just go and get me a drink of water? I'm going to tell you the very short version of this story. So Narda goes off to get God a drink of water, and he knocks on the first door he comes to, and this beautiful woman opens the door, and he instantly falls in love with this woman, and they get married, and they have three actually beautiful children. He builds a big business. He has the best life in the world. He loves his life. And everybody in their village loves them. It's just like what I was saying at Sunday service the other day, the story with Asha's father. Everything can be just right, and delusion's just such a thin veil. And then one day a flood comes to the village, and in a sequence of events, his wife is carried off with a child. He's trying to hold on to one child. That child gets taken away from him. His whole life is just whisked away from him, and he's knocked unconscious. And when he comes to, God was saying, Narda, Narda, I sent you for a glass of water. What took you so long? You know, and Narda had gone and had this whole life and walked away from God, who he was already with. It's just so easy for us to have this happen. Later on, here we are talking about perseverance, but some of the qualities that we're not really going to get to tonight, but I'll just move around like this with the time we have left, is if you look a little further down the road, some of the last few qualities. Steadfastness of purpose is one of them. And it just means that same thing, that when your purpose and your ideals are right, that it is a virtue to stand by them steadfastly, to bring that energy, not to be stubborn. It doesn't mean stubborn. And these are the way things get confused. You know, I'm always amazed when I give a sermon on Sunday, as particularly when it happens, people come up and they talk to you, and every person that talks to me will tell me exactly what they thought. It was so perfect, Shanti, that you talked about fill in the blank. Sometimes I don't even think I've said a word about it. But they've gotten whatever they need to get. And then people will often take it and apply it the way they want to apply it. We all do this. Believe me, I've often said to myself, what do you think Swamiji is saying about you right now? You know, so I'm saying this with great humility. But we can get confused, easily confused, about when are we supposed to be steadfast? What are we supposed to be applying energy towards? This is near the end of the Gita. This is the 16th chapter of 18 chapters. And Krishna is speaking to his highest devotee. So he's saying to him, he's saying all of these things around spiritual principles. Remember, he's saying that which is ennobling, that which is going to lead us towards smriti, towards remembering who we are. Sattvic charity, interesting. Sattvic means calm, centered, as opposed to rajasic, which is outward energy, or tamasic, which is kind of, I mean, it's a real shortcut for all of these terms. There are several chapters in the Gita itself just devoted to tamasic, rajasic, and sattvic. But sattvic really, in essence, means calm, centered, on the right path. Rajasic means emotional, outward energy, and tamasic means really a bit of laziness in some ways, not being able to draw your energy up and grab onto it when you mean it. But sattvic charity in this case means, as I wrote here, it means the kind, it's, we're talking about charity, but it really means generosity in terms of how we hold others, how we think of others, that we're not critical. And Swamiji spends a great deal of time in his commentary here talking about how important it is when we talk about generous in terms of our opinion of others, not to have people feel subservient to us, how different it is than compassion, whereas compassion sort of sets you apart from the other person in a way. It has a little bit more of an I-thou relationship. And Swamiji's saying, no, you hold this person in a way, just remembering that we're all one. Anything you are, I am too. And so it has more of a feeling of oneness in this, the type of charity or generosity that he's talking about. He talks a lot about how to hold people in this way so that when we give to them this kind of a generosity of spirit, that we never make people feel like obliged to us in a way, that we never put them in a feeling that they feel like they owe us anything. Very tricky. how you give things to people and what you give. Sometimes you think you're doing, I do it a lot because I have a lot of that wanting to give, and I have to be very careful that it actually is about the other person and not about me wanting to give. I was just meeting with somebody here in the church yesterday who wants to come and wants to start really participating in the church, and I happen to know this man. He's an extremely multi-talented man. There's probably nothing we could ask him to do. He could write newsletters for us. He could build this church if he wanted to. He's just very talented. He really is. I know him. And when he came and said, okay, I'm ready to dive in, I was like, I thought I died and went to heaven right in my office in there. But he stopped me at one point, and he said to me, and we've known each other for a long time, he told me what his sign was, and I don't remember right now. And I had to tell him I didn't know what that meant. He said, that means I don't like a lot of public acclaim. I don't like a lot of too much of great job. And I had to stop, and I said to him, I hear you. And he said to me, thank you. It was such a profound conversation because I realized that I had to be respectful of who he was and how much I gave to him and when at every moment, but I'm going to need to be behaving in a respectful way if I'm going to be generous in this way that Swamiji's talking about. These are profound spiritual lessons I really felt given to in that moment. Self-restraint, retaining always the feeling of being centered inwardly in the self. And I wrote here, I sort of summarized this. Swamiji says to enjoy good things, but to always realize that the source of enjoyment is from our own heart. It's not in the thing. And so he's talking about self-restraint, again, pulling all of our experiences in, realizing, telling ourselves, repeating over and over, everything comes from God, everything, so that... Because as soon as we start enjoying the thing, the activity, I mean, he talks a lot in his commentary about food and sex. I mean, that would be such obvious things that you can... There's a friend of mine who I go out for dinner with frequently, and having dinner with her is like this. She exclaims from the beginning of the meal to the end, isn't this fabulous? This is the best thing. Oh, my God, I love this food. And then she'll stop about 5 minutes later and say to me, aren't you enjoying it? Yes, I'm enjoying it, but I mean, it looks so different. So I think that's, and I know for sure that's exactly the kind of thing he's talking about. There's a way, even with sex, and he goes on to explain it, so that you, it's not that you're denying yourself when it's not right to deny yourself, but it's that you keep yourself a little separate from the activity itself so that you can keep your energy raised. Otherwise, of course, what happens with all of these activities? Certainly with food and sex, we can see it very clearly. If it's good, more is better. And that is a lot of what happens in our society, is that no matter how much people have, we find we just want more of it. So everything in moderation is what self-respect means. Okay, talking about moderation, self-restraint. I mean, not self-respect. But to restrain myself right now, I'm going to stop so that Lahari and B. Raj can take over here.
Pick the highlights. I'm going to start this at this end. And each person take a flower. You know, we had earlier the thought that anything we offer with sincere devotion, a flower or a leaf or anything. So just of these ones we've gathered from the piazza, don't listen, Sahadev, I just... asked which flowers wanted to be offered to Krishna, and these definitely said they wanted to, so you probably wouldn't mind. So in kind of wrapping up, it was wonderful. Thank you, Shanti, for giving that list of 26 things. The Gita is so full of inspiration and motivation and encouragement and challenges, and this is how you do it, and why don't you do it more, and let's all go. And it's, you know, it's a many lifetime study. So to do it in 4 weeks, it's really nice to have that little succinct list here to look at for things that we can do. When we started with this, we said we were going to talk about the heart of the Gita. And
a really fun one to talk about, and I'm going to close with sort of the heart of the Gita, but also sort of the heart of the devotee in relationship to Krishna. Because it says in the Gita, I'm not going to find which chapter right now, but that, yes, wisdom is great. We do gain wisdom as we meditate and we observe and we introspect. That comes. Wisdom comes, and we can use our mind for discrimination. But it says in the Gita, that path is very hard, to just try wisdom and just try the impersonal God. So what really helps us go quickly is to think of God as the beloved, to find some way to make it personal and real, a relationship that is give and take and dynamic and deep. And Yogananda said, you have to individually make love to God. And that is the path of the heart of the devotee. There's a talk here about bhakti yoga, which I'll go into in just a minute. But I want to read you something. We kept talking about how comforting the Gita is, and that's one of the things Yogananda said about the Gita. He said it's so lovely because it's so comforting to the devotee. Because the guru's there and he's saying, anybody, like we were reading earlier, anybody can come to me. Even a little practice of this inward religion will free you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. We hear that every week. That if you just love God, if you just offer a leaf, if you offer your thoughts, if you offer your seva, if you do anything to forward that relationship, it's like God is the divine beloved. And what would you do for your divine beloved? What do you do for your children and your husband and your wife? How do you show them that you love them? Well, you think of them, you offer them things, you care for them, you think about how to please them and how to be with them and have special times together and celebrations. And God is that beloved that's within the heart of all the ones we love and of all the love we hope to receive that's coming from God. And if we can sort of short-circuit the indirect methods that our love takes through things and people and experiences, and just go inside and really try, as Shanti was saying, rest in that love, you know, allow ourselves, our hearts to open to give that love. Because when we're giving something, we can't, it can't escape us. We can't be without it if we're giving it. So the ways that we find in our devotion to give our love to God is one of the ways to, as Yogananda said, you must whip up the devotion in the heart. He also said in that same vein that chanting is half the battle. Why? Because it opens our heart, doesn't it? We start thinking, God, I love you. We start singing these words, whether we even know what they mean sometimes, just to get into the feeling and the bhav of the sound, these sacred chants that have been chanted to God, that Yogananda and that Swamiji have done and that others have done. It allows our thoughts and our breath. We start breathing when we sing. We start breathing harder, and we offer our heart into the song and into what we have, the feelings and the hopes and the dreams and the longings of the heart, that relationship of the heart of the devotee with God. And there's a part here which I'm going to read, and then we're going to have a little treat tonight, because we have, you know, Sir Edwin Arnold's version of the Gita, which Yogananda used for a long time until his own, he wrote his own. It's called the Song Celestial, and Sai Ganesh, who is from a special tradition in India, where they train from a very young age, his family and your father and maybe your grandfather, mother and grandmother. So it, you know, generations have done this as a sadhana from the time they were children, where you sing to God, you sing with God, and you let God sing through you. And that's always the goal of our singing. But it's fun to have Sai Ganesh and others who've had a lot of experience vibrating with that. So we'll have that song as a reward. So once you get tired of all the words, which could come soon, then you get a break. You get to just relax and enjoy the song. But there's a part here that Yogananda mentioned in the autobiography of a yogi. When any devotee would come to him, he said, memorize my poem, Samadhi, because he wanted us to see the divine consciousness is bigger than we think it is. As Shanti was saying, it's that direction of expansion and expansion and expansion. I mean, infinity is really big. Omnipresence is way out there. So how do we, you know, move in that direction? And imagination is very helpful. And knowing that an avatar says this is what it feels like, this is what it looks like, is also, I find, very comforting. Because when I start thinking, oh, it's this, I'm struggling with this, and this is my karma, and I better, you know, do this, and I'm not doing that, and all the 26 keys that I'm not doing any of them, or whatever it is, I'm thinking, oh, but this isn't the real reality, all of this. This path, this battlefield, I have to fight it, it's my dharma, I will. But to take a break once in a while and just say, okay, God, I'm just going to imagine that I'm already with you. That I don't have to do any more of this karma, dharma, sadhana, any of this stuff. I'm just going to be with you. I'm just going to say, we're now one. And what does that look like? I'm just going to sit on your lap and kind of look at the world out of your eyes if I can. And you know, what does that look like? So I love the poem Samadhi, and I read it regularly. And this gave me another little bit where in one of the chapters, there's the divine vision. Chapter 11, I think you're right, where... Okay, so Arjuna says, all right, I'll fight. You know, you're my guru. I will follow you. I love you. I turn to you. Guide me, instruct me. And he does with much good advice, much good wisdom, much good to-dos list. And then he says, you know, it's that devotion. It's when you give yourself totally to me that I can give myself to you. And he gives him an experience of his infinite consciousness, the divine vision. And afterward, he says, you know, I don't give this to anybody. You know, people who do the rituals, who do the seva, who do the to-do list, who make it, you know, all this stuff, they don't necessarily get this. You know, the one that gets this is one who gives themselves to me completely, just without thinking, without worrying, without trying, without effort, but with full, it's the purity of heart, and it's the full energy that you give yourself to God. And then he says, ah, now I can give myself to you because it's open. You know, you've opened the door for me. So he does this, and I'm going to read this a little bit long. But this is going to be Arjuna because Krishna says, I now show you my something divine. I think it's consciousness divine. My paper's got out of order here. We'll say consciousness divine. So then Krishna starts to expand. And in many of the images you see him, he's got about 100 faces looking everywhere because, you know, it's sort of trying to show in a limited little graphic way he is everywhere. He can see everything. He is everywhere. So he starts to expand out in this vision. Arjuna says, most wonderful Lord, adored of gods, within thy cosmic form I behold the vast universe of beings, saints and sages divine, sequestered in remote caves, their serpent nature, Kundalini, formerly virulent, now tamed, raised by love on the rod of awakening. Lord Brahma, God of gods, seated on the head of each sage, his seat, the shining lotus of 1,000 rays. O cosmic bodied Lord of all worlds, I behold thee everywhere and in everything. Innumerable bodies, faces, eyes reveal thy energy. Inscrutable to me are your origins, your reigns, your endings. O blazing effulgence, overwhelming light. The glory of thy name spreads everywhere to darkest corners of the universe. Diademed with stars, wielding the mace of sovereign power, your discus of whirling vortices of light, dazzling, illuminating, thrilling all. Immortal, supreme Brahman, supreme resting place of all created forms, guardian of eternal law, high wisdom's throne, thy self-born luster shields thy devotees from harm.
protecting all beings and calling them to wakefulness in thee. O Sovereign One, the beings of earth, the astral gods, all awe-stricken, with folded palms, offer thee adoration. With prostrations enter thy cosmic temple and offer thee their love, their heart's devotion. Raising hymns to the starry dome of heaven, they worship thee and thee alone. The lights of heaven, blazing suns, the lamps of consciousness, hermits, sages, emperors of benign rule, noble heralds of thy peace, the strong, the powerful, the desire-filled, the ambitious, bow in wonder before thy radiant throne, or fall otherwise before thee, fear-filled, vanquished, their petty lives consumed in the cosmic fire. Thee I behold, thy feet walking everywhere, thy countless limbs busy throughout space, thy mouths consuming, thy eyes flashing, thy hair streaming out with energy across the sky. O thou joyous, overpowering, all-obliterating light, I stand before thee trembling, awe-filled. Egos, karmas, desires, ambitions, victories all rush toward thee for reabsorption in thy bliss, or else soon crumble into wasted dust. So do the rushing rivers of innumerable lives flow impetuously, blindly to thy sea. Moths drawn to a flame there perish. So do human lives drawn by ambition, ever hopeful but ever doomed to devastation, the fog of passion obscuring from them truth. Who art thou, Lord? What is thy cosmic will? What is thy purpose? To what end has all this been done? Awe-stricken, he starts to come back and has questions again. You know, what does it mean? What is your will? What's going to happen? And the Blessed Lord, here they are on the battlefield, he says, I am time, I am Kala. Disguised as endless doom I come. I seize, I obliterate. Even were you not to fight those foes, these foes you gaze upon at Kurukshetra would perish, Arjuna, slain by my mighty will. Indeed, I slew them long ago. Don't take it so seriously, you know. The Guru says, I'm in charge. God says, nothing dies. You know, these battles that you have, you know, it's funny, at Ananda you see karmas come and karmas go and swirl, and after a while, you know, they used to seem so real, you know, to watch people go through their things and you want to get in there with them, and then it's sort of like you just sort of stood back, and after a while you see so many of them, and then you think, you know, that's like a little tempest in a teapot, you know, just a little thing going on, these little karmas. Swamiji said us in his last letter to us for Easter, he was in extreme dispassion state. He was in Vairagya. And he said, excuse me, but I care for your souls. The only thing I'm sorry about is that I can't take you all with me. You know, I think he saw he was going to go pretty soon, though we didn't know it. He seemed to. He said, but I hope you don't mind. I don't care at all about your ego dramas anymore. I don't care about your upsets and your hang-ups and your challenges. You know, I hope you don't mind. I don't really care about them anymore, but I care about your soul. You know, I do care about your soul. And for a long time, he was kind enough to engage and help teach us through the dramas and the karmas that community people had over time. But, you know, as he started going into this state of consciousness, the omnipresent state, he just realized, you know, that's not who you are. I'm not going to relate to you that way. That's not how I'm going to say goodbye. I'm just going to say, you know, I'm sort of wish I could take you all with me, and I see you all as souls. You're all souls. And then after this great big expansion, which was bigger than Arjuna was used to, he said, oh my gosh, Lord, I love this phrase. He says, it's wonderful that you've shown me yourself as cosmic, infinite, everything, but I'm trembling. It's just too big, and my hair is standing up on end, and I'm longing for you to come back as my friend, so that I can, you know, feel the comfort again of that relationship. And that's what the guru does, comes to us again and again as a friend, as our friends, as the divine friend, as the Sadguru, as the guru and the representatives, so that we can feel comfortable, you know, familiar. We're all doing this together, and we are. And when great saints like Swamiji and all these great masters come and live, they were all doing it together with their disciples. And that also is a comfort that God gives by giving us a way to relate to a personal form. It's really hard to be bhakti, devotional. I offer my eternal love to, as Swamiji called it, the cosmic ground of being. You know, it leaves you a little cold. But if you say, oh, there's this beautiful saint, there's this beautiful life, this incarnation of God that is so lovable. There's Krishna with his flute. We've been tuning into him. And his when he dances with the devotees, he dances with all the devotees, and they all feel blissful in that divine love that they share with him. And so when we have that, it allows us to open our heart more, also to have the longing. You know, you read the autobiography, Yogananda's life and the lives of saints that we might read, and Swamiji's life, and it allows us to say, ah, he did it, look what he did, you know, to stand back and think about the tests and the consciousness and the even-mindedness and the creativity and, you know, this 26 keys that were mastered by these great souls. And they're our friends. They lived not that long ago. They wrote their books. You know, we can sort of draw their vibrations out of the books and out of the tapes and the classes and through the devotees that have been trained and through all of us as we tune in and say, how can I serve? How can I be with my friend and help them have the word, have the remembrance of God in this situation at work? Or, you know, we often feel there's this line between I'm at Ananda and I'm in the world, or I've been struggling with this myself. I'm in the ashram serving a master and the gurus, and now I'm going out with this amazing family party for a 90th birthday for relatives and people that are just like, whoa, way out there. It's like, I don't want to do that. But but, you know, I have to remind myself, where is the separation? You know, isn't God there? Isn't God everywhere in the flowers and the plants and our job and our friends? You know, where is God not? And I remember when I first came on the path, I found it very, very comforting. This is the way I approach the whole concept of omnipresence. Oh, goody, God is everywhere. That way I can't lose track of him for very long. And just to remind, you know, to remind ourselves. So I thought we'd just close this evening by having this lovely music that we have planned with Sai Ganesh, and practicing, making it an active practice. Yes, Sai Ganesh is singing, and Viraj will play for him, but all of us, if we can enter into the act of devotion that the songs and the thoughts and the music all have going, we can sort of join in that flow with ourselves and with our own hearts opening. And then after that, it would be nice if we could have a little flower ceremony. You can imagine Krishna is any god that you want. He's standing in the place of the divine tonight in honor of the Gita. And just to make an offering. You can also make it at the big altar if you prefer, but just somewhere where your flower, mostly your love, as we say, even a flower or a leaf, if it's offered with that pure-hearted love, God finds it very pleasing. So we'll finish with that. And while we do that, if you could chant a song for us, like Sri Gurudeva, maybe?
I have a love who's far away, far away, far away. I have a love who's far away. stars. Mother, you stole my heart away, heart away, heart away. Mother, you stole my heart away, farther away than the stars. Keep me not bound here, teach me to fly, far from earth's madness, freer I die. Keep me not bound, ma, teach me to fly, farther away than the stars. There's nothing here nearly so dear, nearly so dear, nearly so dear. There's nothing here nearly so dear, though farther away than the stars. Mother, I know your love's ever near, though farther away than the stars. All your children, mother, call you, knowing not it's you they call. Some through mists of their unknowing, bruised and hurting when they fall, turn away, but who can leave you? You, the mother of us all. If a child forgets its mother, will she coldly turn away? Wise or foolish, we're your children. Guide us, mother, if we stray. Those whose hearts are torn with anguish lack the power your name to call. Heal their wounds, ma, soothe their sorrows. You, the mother of us all. Heal their wounds, ma, soothe their sorrows. You,